This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com. Welcome to Dishy Mix. I'm your host, Susan Fratton. And on today's show, you're going to get to meet Bob Schmetterer. He's a creative leader, a communications visionary, and an author. We're going to talk about his book. You may know Bob. Most recently, he was chairman and CEO of Euro RSCG, one of the biggest global agencies. And I've known Bob since the mid-90s when I met him because he was probably the most amazing keynote speaker at an ad tech. And I've just tracked and stayed connected to him all these years. He's retired from Euro RSCG in 2004, and we're going to find out not only what it's been like to be part of the growth of advertising from the 70s through the turn of the century, but also what he's learned in those years now that he can look back on it from his yacht, the Blue Moon. Before we get into meeting Bob, I want to tell you a couple things. I just went to the post office and I mailed out a ton of swag to you Dishy Mix listeners. And I want to tell you, I really enjoyed that trip to the post office. I sent Hoopla, a bunch of books of Hoopla, to all my friends all over the country. I even sent one to Danius Blinus, a McCann employee out of Lithuania. I sent a Hoopla cycling jersey to Dana Todd, one of my regular listeners. I sent tons of books, Tell 3000 from Pete Blackshaw, Social Media An Hour a Day from Dave Evans, and I have some autographed copies still here to give away of Bill Tanser's book, Click, and Branding Only Works on Cattle, the show you listened to last week with Jonathan Salem Baskin, the singer of the Sock Puppet Blues. So let me send those to you. You probably know the drill, but in case you're a new listener, all you have to do is post an interesting request that I like and I choose at dishymixfan.com. That's my Facebook fan club. Just fan me, post your desire, and I hope I'll be able to take a trip to the post office and send you an autographed copy of the book of your choice.
This idea that chicken, which is a commodity and didn't exist as any brand, could in fact be a branded commodity, a branded product, a branded idea. And his name was Frank Perdue. And that opportunity to work with Frank himself, to work with Ed McCabe, to work with Sam Scali, was the beginning of my belief that advertising was something that could be genuinely worthwhile. Things that inevitably happen in a consolidation, the sense of courageous thinking became drained from the business. And even those agencies that, you know, that started as digital agencies and now have been absorbed, you know, they're still catching up to the change because the change is so profound and so large. And at the same time, the incredible fragmentation of media has made the job of what used to be called advertising very different.
Welcome, Bob. How are you?
Wonderful to be on Dishy Mix, one of my favorite things to listen to and to hear about and read about. And I'm speaking to you live today from the Motor Yacht Blue Moon at Ocean Reef Club in Key Largo, Florida.
You are? Oh, my gosh. That is so great. I love it. So you're on your yacht.
Yes, absolutely, on the yacht.
Wow, that's exciting. This is my first yacht interview. So on the show today, Bob, you and I have been doing some planning. We're going to talk about the advertising business decade by decade. We're going to talk a little bit about yachting. I want to hear more about that yacht. We're going to talk about the power of the pause, because you have the most powerful pause of any man or woman I know. We're going to talk about your Studio 54 decadence era, because we want to hear all the dishy, juicy stuff. And we're going to talk about living a creative life, which is what you've done, Bob. So tell our listeners just a tiny bit about your history, because we want to get into your thoughts on the world of advertising over these decades.
Well, I think, you know, I had a sort of a nondescript childhood, except as I started going to school and learning some more and being exposed to people, I pretty early found myself struggling, you know, with this notion of who am I? What am I? What am I about? And And at some point, it occurred to me, because I'd find myself attracted to artistic things, to painting or photography, and then I'd find myself equally attracted to learning more about business or learning more about mathematics. And this sort of struggle between left and right brain, I think, really was a difficult part of my childhood and reason why I didn't do very well in school, until something really fortuitous happened. I got married when I was 19 years old and fell in love with my high school sweetheart, and got me into the workforce very early on, and wound up doing something that I loved, which was being around automobiles. And once I was around automobiles, and I was going to school at night and studying psychology, I suddenly began to think that there's this whole idea that work could actually be fun, and that in work you could find the opportunity to have both a creative side and a logical side at play at one point in time. So fast forward, I started off working for a car company, and then I was discovered by a young advertising agency named Scally McCabe Slows, who tried to convince me I should be doing advertising, and I absolutely rejected the idea. I said, what do you think I am, one of those guys carrying a bag around, to show ideas to clients? And in any case, it turned out to be one of the most exciting moves of my life, and I worked for Scally McCabe Slows, became president of its New York agency, then was recruited by Y&R to be the head of a big joint venture with Marsteller and a European company. Then I started my own agency with some great partners called Messner Viteri, Berger, McNamee, Schmetterer, and then that was acquired by Euro RCG Worldwide, and after they acquired us, they asked me if I would run that company. So in a nutshell, that's sort of how I got to where I am, and still I'm trying to figure out that left and right brain, but that's another story.
Well, it sounds like instead of figuring it out, you just let it work its balance out. There's in your book is called Leap, A Revolution in Creative Business Strategy, and we'll get to that, but there was a funny quote in there. You said that Martin Slows was one of the mentors for you, and the quote cracked me up. It said, he said to you something like, you bring the substance, I'll bring the style, and we'll both be farting through velvet. I can just imagine, like, did he have a cigar? Was he sitting behind a desk? Did he have a pot belly?
No, Marvin was, and still is. He lives in Tuscany now, but Marvin was a very, very well-schooled, well-educated man, very artistic, very sensitive, and extremely well-dressed all the time. And in his trying to convince me how I could really make have a role in advertising and in the agency, he said that. And I have to say, when I did the book, I had to get permission, for the quotes.
Yeah.
And I contacted him, and he wrote back, and he said, I know I said that, but will everyone understand that it was sort of an old garment district joke?
Oh, is that right? It's what the Shmata say, you'll be farting through silk.
You'll be farting through velvet.
I always heard silk, but the same, yeah.
Anyway,
that was funny.
The origin of it.
The personality of that quote is just so classic. I can see why it stayed with you for years. And I do also want to come back to your startup agency, the Mez.
Yeah.
It was Messner, Vetterer. I'm going to get this right because I remember this, Berger, Carrie Schmetterer. Did I get
that's
that
correct.
Right? Good for
that's,
me.
That's what it was. Although a client of mine who liked me particularly used to call it Schmetterer, et cetera. So we could have shortened it. But that was, that is the name.
Well, I want to come back to that time when you started up that agency with those guys and you had no clients, because that's got to be a good story. But really, the first thing I want to get out of you is, here you are calling me from your yacht. You're a big agency, mucky muck. You got years of experience. Walk us through kind of the changes decade by decade that you saw in the average. How would you typify those changes in the advertising business?
I think I was really fortunate to enter the business at very young. As I said, I was married young. I went to school at night for 9 years. And then Marvin convinced me to be in advertising, and I joined Scally McCabe Slows in 1971. And that was at the height of what was going to be called the creative revolution. You had these extremely talented, wonderful copywriters and art directors who were beginning to not just work for little clients, but in fact win major clients. And part of it was that decade and its kind of fearlessness in a certain way. And the ability for agencies to really say to clients, this is what you need to do, this is the right thing to do, and as opposed to saying, what would you like us to do, and we'll do it. It was a very exciting time to be in the business in the 70s for that reason, and you had a dozen or more brilliant agencies start up, and at least dozens more, you know, come after them in that legacy. So I feel fortunate to have entered the business at that time and worked with and seen some of the most exciting and wonderful creative thinking in the history of advertising.
What was Mary Wells' book?
Mary Wells' book that she did a couple years ago was called A Big Life.
That was a good book. If you want to really know that era, that 70s, 80s era of advertising, that your real core time, she wrote a good book on that too, didn't you think?
Outstanding book of that time and frankly of her whole life in a certain way, you know, being a function of that time. So, no, extremely good book, very readable and highly recommended.
Yeah. So the 70s were this big ideas that big companies were coming and saying, Madison Avenue was really getting formed. Big companies were coming in and saying, do my campaigns for me. You talk about Purdue in the book as being Volvo and Purdue being two big ones that you kind of completely branded, right?
Well, those are the two that changed my life. I had actually worked for Volvo as their marketing research director when I was in my early 20s. And that's where Marvin met me there because Scally became the Volvo agency in the late 60s. And that's how we got to know each other, and that's where that transition happened. But when I went to work at Scally, aside from the opportunity to eventually fart through velvet, I've done work with cars. I'd really like to do something else. And, you know, and Marvin said, well, yeah, the first new client that comes in, you'll have a chance to, you know, to work with whoever that is. And this guy came in from Salisbury, Maryland with this idea that chicken, which is a commodity and didn't exist as any brand, could in fact be a branded commodity, a branded product, a branded idea. And his name was Frank Perdue. And that opportunity to work with Frank himself, to work with Ed McCabe, to work with Sam Scally, was the beginning of my belief that advertising was something that could be genuinely worthwhile. Child of the 60s, growing up, the last thing you could think about is advertising. That was, you know, telling people to do something they didn't want to do. But the idea of telling people who wouldn't otherwise know that there is a real difference in the quality of a product and to demonstrate that with a lot of fun and a lot of humor, very exciting time for me. And that continued with Volvo when I finally did go back and work with Volvo, because Volvo is another example, very tiny company by automobile standards in terms of the number of cars they make and sell, and by any right shouldn't even exist as a car company, and yet this very special car company who believed in safety above all else, with the right branding, with the right people, really created a phenomenon and stood out in the world. So those two kind of set for me why I had found the right business to be in.
And so that was the 70s. Tell me the difference between how advertising changed from the 70s to the 80s and the 80s to the 90s.
I think the big changes, frankly, were at that from then on sort of structural. You know, one of the things I like to think about when I think about the 70s, and certainly was true in the late 60s with Birnbach and some of the other really great agencies, Mary Wells, is that there was a courageousness of being able to go to new ways of communicating and to selling. And I've always felt, you know, creative thinking and creative business needs a courageous time, or people who are not fearful to be able to flourish. What happened in the 80s was the beginning of no one really saw it right away, but of a massive change in the structure of the business. And by that I mean you suddenly, and in many ways it was really started by the Saatchis in London, who took their company public. There had been a public agency before, but the idea of taking what was a hot startup agency, growing it into a big company in London, then going on the stock market with it, raising money, and then going out and acquiring really an enormous number of other agencies. People forget, but the little chief financial officer of Saatchi at the time was Martin Sorrell. And so, in a way, it was the beginning of this era of advertising becoming a big business as well as an exciting business of great creative thinking. and the consolidation, the acquisitions of the 80s changed the business in a way. And as it did that, and more companies were consolidated under these massive holding companies, one of the things that happened, as it does with all acquisitions of public companies, people got fired, you know, there was a downsizing, all the things that inevitably happen in a consolidation, the sense of courageous thinking became drained from the business.
Mm.
And along with fearfulness is hiding from being courageous with your ideas and courageous with how you approach a client. I used to say to people all the time, you know, the worst thing that could happen to you is you could get fired.
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with that?
Right.
You know, and yet, of course, there's a lot wrong with that.
Sure.
There's a lot of fear. We're living in that period right now. So
that,
to me, and as a result, the nature of the ideas and the work became much blander, much maybe as it had been back in the 50s, and more and simply less exciting by and large in the United States particularly. Less so in the rest of the world, but particularly in the United States. And for me, at least, that period of the 80s, and it's one of the reasons that during that period, the middle part, later part of the 80s, you began to see some more startups again coming into the business, offering alternatives to these big consolidated kind of average thinking companies.
And so what do you see happening now? Is there anything that you're getting a sense of that's kind of the next era of the agency world?
Well, I think, you know, certainly there was this, and when you and I first met in ad tech to me was always just a great idea in its fruition of realizing that advertising and technology with the advent of the internet and with the advent of digital communications in the broadest sense was creating a new chapter. You know, advertising has always, despite the fact that agencies like to think they create everything, in fact has always followed the media. And so when advertising was primarily print, agencies were based on print. When the media was primarily print, when the media became radio, the agencies changed. They started producing radio shows. When TV came on, they started producing television shows and becoming, you know, involved in that. So the media has always led the way. And certainly, you know, with the advent and the explosive quickness of the advent of digital communications in general, the internet in specific, it's made possible an enormous amount of other things. The problem is, I think it's happened so quickly, agencies are still catching up to it. And even those agencies that, you know, that started as digital agencies and now have been absorbed, you know, they're still catching up to the change because the change is so profound and so large. And at the same time, the incredible fragmentation of media has made the job of what used to be called advertising very different. So the answer to, you know, where it is now and where it's going, it's become, on the media side, highly fragmented and made opportunities, obviously, for great media planning agencies to be creative and necessitated advertising agencies. The big ones in the world make well less than 40% of their revenues from advertising. 60% of their revenues are coming from traditional advertising, are coming from database marketing and interactive marketing and sponsorships and all kinds of other communications forms, public relations and so forth. So you have a fragmentation of how creative is done. It is, with one big exception, one of the great creative opportunities of all time exists in the era we're living in. Whenever you have massive change going on a social level, there is always wonderful opportunity to find new ways of expressing what products are about or services are about and tapping into that. The thing that's holding that back, I think, is going back to my old sense that, you know, you can divide creative periods into those that have fear and those that have courage, and we're living in a very fearful time right now, and I think that's a major issue for the industry in general and for, frankly, for the world.
You know, it's funny. I'm speaking this week to a group called the Aspen Group. They're a group of some of the leaders in the digital media environment, and I'm conducting a workshop on managing change. I'm going to go through confronting your fears and anxieties, actually like making them very tangible and writing them down and then looking at them rationally, because we tend to let things kind of eat away at us that are almost not entirely unfounded, but not completely thought through fears.
Right.
I've come up with some techniques to manage the stress of change using the newest concepts in psychotherapy and neuroscience, like mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is a really interesting new area that can be brought into the corporate culture. And then being a leader through change, how do you create an emotional container for all that charge that's created when there is, you know, a downshift, a down cycle in the market, advertising's hit really hard? What can you do both for yourself and for your organization and for your team to get everyone through these kind of harrowing times when we have our downturns? It's going to be a lot of fun. It's the first time I've done something like this, and I've done a lot of research to put it together, and I'm looking forward to it. I hope that, you know, we do get ourselves really worried about all these things. Advertising gets hit so hard when we have these downturns in the market. And I'm hoping I'll at least be able to make some positive impact on a few people who lead some teams.
Well, you've got, you know, it sounds like an exciting notion, and hopefully you'll have a future dishy mix based on it, because it's a very, very exciting opportunity. The secret word, and you used it a couple times just now, you know, is this idea of leadership and, mm-hmm. and who are leaders and what does that mean? I used to, before my mother passed away, whenever we would speak, which was never often enough apparently, but when we would speak, she would say to me at the end of the conversation, she would say, "Bob, how are they treating you?" And I would say, "Mom, I am they." Because in her world, and frankly in the world of lots of people, you know, there's always, they're looking for someone else to lead and someone else to solve and someone else to make it all right. And one of the things that I think happens during down times is people who have the instincts and the abilities to lead, you know, are just simply afraid to. So I think overcoming those, you know, and realizing you are they, you know, I am they.
Yeah.
Sometimes I would say to her, "I am they, and they are treating me badly." that would start another whole thing. But I think that idea of inspiring the thing that you're good at, that talk that you're doing, of inspiring leadership in teams and realizing that that's how things get done, that's how things change, that's what creates positive energy and great creative thinking. Wonderful.
We have to go to a break to thank our sponsors who advertise, and we love that. When we come back, I want to talk to you about the power of the pause. I have a lot of things we still have to get to. So stay tuned. Hang on with me, Bob, and we'll be right back after we thank our sponsors.
Listen to Coaching the Life Coach, Business and Marketing Strategies for Growth of Transformational Practices, your guide in the 21st Century Marketplace on personallifemedia.com.
All right, we're back, and we're with Bob Schmetterer. He is calling us from his yacht in Key Largo. And Bob, one of the things that I wanted to do was to just get a really, what the hell was going through your mind when you started up that agency with Tom and Rob and Barry and Wally, and you had no business and you started the agency? How did you make the leap, and what did you do? What advice can you give us who are starting companies now while you're looking back at it?
Well, I think two things. I had made a judgment at that point. That was after my 13 years at Scally McCabe and rising to run that company, and also having then also been the CEO of a big international company for Y&R. I decided that the thing that I most wanted to do was to have my own agency, and I'd probably wanted to do that for a long time, but I just didn't. And
You said you wished you'd done it sooner.
I do.
In the grand scheme of things.
I do, and I do wish I had done it sooner. And part of that, again, has to do with, you know, battling that, you know, comfort level, which is part of what makes for, it's not so much fear, but safety, as opposed to, you know, going out and trying something new and so forth. So I was very clear I wanted to do that, and I had been approached by a number of people to start an agency. some people who wanted to back it, and some traditional, you know, art directors. I say traditional, highly talented art directors and writers. And most of the format for an agency, you know, in startup, in advertising, was always you had an account person, you had a copywriter, you had an art director, and that together the three of you can do anything. And then, you know, what happens over time, great advertising people morph into anything, and you don't even put them in one of those categories. I knew Ron Berger because he had worked for me at Scally McCabe Sloves, and he and Tom Messner and Barry Vetiri had worked together at a great agency called Alley and Gargano. And we knew each other sort of socially and so forth. And these guys had decided that they wanted to start an agency. And then Wally Carey was someone they knew and worked with on political advertising on the Tuesday team, which was the first Reagan one,
yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so they decided to start this agency. And out of the blue, Ron called me and he said, listen, I hear that you're going to start an agency. Why don't you come and join us on this startup? Because you know we've already announced what we're doing, and I said, Ron, you've got four people with no business. You know, what do you need five people with no business for? He laughed and he said, well, come and talk to us, and we did. And I met them, and I went home that night, and one of the lessons that I had learned at Scally McCabe Sloves, and frankly had learned in life in general, is that the power of a very strong partnership in a creative business is quite remarkable, because if you have partners who are not competing with each other, but in fact are doing different things, literally the amount of time you have to devote to clients and the amount of time that you have to devote to the business is very different. So I said, look, you know, the average person can work like 2,000 hours or something like that, you know, and if you've got three people, you can work 6,000 hours. We've got five, we have 10,000 hours. You know, why can't we be better than anyone else if we have 10,000 hours to give to our clients? And so we decided, and these were mature fellas. I mean, Tom, I, and Barry are about the same age. Ron's a couple years younger, but we were all at that point in our 40s. And that's not normally when you start an agency, but, you know, they had been around and been in successful agencies. And I think out of this came something that I felt very vibrant about, and that was a willingness to say, let's reexamine the whole idea of how an agency can be structured and running. Remember, now we're talking about almost 1990. It was 87. And everything had changed. You could have a computer on your desktop affordably. You couldn't do that before. The world was beginning to change from a communication standpoint. And we figured with five very strong partners, any one of which could have had their own agency, it would be a unique proposition in an era where everything else was the same. So we structured it differently. I remember giving a talk at one of the ad techs about the structure of it. We structured it as a law firm, you know, not with a pyramid, but with five equal partners. And we set about to try to redefine the nature of how an agency can work.
And did you feel like you did do that? And did that redefinition help you win business that otherwise you would not have had you had an older structure?
Absolutely, no question about it. I think it turned out to be a hugely successful agency. You know, the first year or 18 months, you know, we struggled along and won some small, nice little businesses and so forth. The breakthrough came in year three or year two and a half, I guess, when we did two things. We made a deal with a big European company called RSCG.
Oh, that's where you got the connection in, ultimately.
Which is where the first connection came in. And they wanted to buy us, and I said, we have nothing to sell. We're just beginning. And I said, no, we believe in you, and so forth. What they did, in essence, was we didn't sell them the agency, but we allowed them to invest in it in a way that freed us up to think about what we needed to do to really make this structure work. What we did was go about the business of winning business in new and unusual ways. And the big breakthrough for us is that we began winning more business, and then we ran in 1991 two really huge clients at that time. One was MCI in its earliest iteration, not after, which is way before WorldCom, but MCI, who Tom had worked with at Alley Gargano and who was challenging AT&T for what was going to become the telecom wars. We competed against big agencies and won, and shocked everybody, winning a client of that size. And then 6 months later, we were fortunate enough to win the Volvo business, and obviously I had stayed in touch with those people, and they needed a new agency. And so within 6 months, we went from 20 people to about 300 people. And then continue to grow and continue to do new and different things. And frankly, without five partners, it would have been impossible to manage the growth and to continue, you know, the exciting career that it had. But we did change the way, you know, our business operated. Again, we were fortunate because technology was making possible file sharing and things that, you know, that today sound like nothing. But
yeah, you said you were one of the first agencies that was on email.
We were one of the first. People forget this, but MCI actually had a form of email very early on called MCI Mail, and one of the things that we said with them is that we want to get on it and want to communicate that way. Once we did that, we would make it a requisite for any new client that say, at least your marketing department has to get on this with us.
Yeah.
So it changed the way you write call reports or the way you would communicate on a daily basis. The other thing that really was important and for us is people, again, forget, but MCI was the number one provider of the Internet backbone before anyone knew there was such a thing as the Internet. They provided the backbone for the National Science Foundation. It allowed us, and we did some early advertising, you may remember, for the Internet. No one knew what we were talking about. We used Anna Paquin, and we were talking about the future and digital technology and how soon everyone will be here and not there. It was sort of a mysterious campaign. But it allowed us to get very early on into this digital revolution and understand it and allow us to use that kind of not only technology but thinking with all of our clients. So it was I always say, you know, there's a lot of good fortune in it. But I think, you know, to me, the things that made it, the lessons learned there was the power of partners. Of as much as one or two people can do, if it's five of the right people, they can do it better. Maybe not forever, but certainly for a period of time.
One of the key takeaways for me in listening to you tell that story was also that two of your biggest accounts came from previous work relationships with whom you'd stayed in touch, which I also think is, you know, maybe that didn't occur to you, but in hearing your story, I noticed that if you're thinking, you know, the advice to people who are considering listening to the show and thinking, okay, I'm ready to go out on my own and start an agency, there's a lot of advice loaded in that. I want to switch subjects with you now, because you're not getting out of this interview without telling us how you learned to be such an amazing speaker. Good speakers are not born. You did some work. What did you do and what did you learn? Tell us the things we can do to be the speakers as good as Bob, to be a speaker as good as Bob Schmetterer.
I think two things happened. I said early on in the show that, you know, I didn't do so well in high school in my early years of education. Well, there were two courses in my junior and senior years that changed my life in certain ways. One was typing.
Yeah, there you go. Email technology. Yeah.
And learning how to type and touch type and that, you know, even today I think you and I reconnected on
Facebook.
Facebook.
I found you on Facebook. I'm like, Bob Schmetterer's on Facebook, and he's doing it from his yacht.
How many retired ad guys do you know who are on Facebook on their yacht?
But I love it.
But typing really was. I mean, it became such an incredible. But the other thing, more to your question, was that I took a class called Speech and Drama, and really loved it, and loved doing some acting. And I've often worked with people and have been asked to work with people on how to become a better public speaker. And I've often said, here's an acting class that you need to take. A part of it is you learn at an acting class is, you know, how to communicate to an audience. And so, you know, when I speak, you know, I've people ask me quite a lot, and they're often very complimentary, as you've been, about my speaking skills. You know, there are about four or five things that, to me, are always needful of being done. The first is really is the material, is feeling a huge obligation to your audience to tell them something interesting, and to tell them something that they're going to want to know about and learn about. And I think it's crucial. It just is, you know, without that material, you're not going to have the level of confidence. And working on that material and getting it right, you're not going to have the level of confidence to do the communications thing. The second thing that, came over time was not listening to what I was saying because I had that down. I knew what I was saying and what I was going to be saying. But looking at the audience and listening to what they were hearing And often you could look into an audience and just by their, you know, you look around and you could see who's nodding their head or who's nodding off or who's focused and who's not. And what are they hearing? Are they hearing what I'm saying? And if they're not, which is often the case, because it's, you know, it's not easy to listen to other people talking, even if it is interesting. The two techniques that you've mentioned, one of that I found very important, is first the art of repetition.
Right. You do that a lot with your hands. You'll say one, two,
yeah,
three. You'll hold your hands up, and then you'll repeat a theme through your presentation.
Exactly.
Uh huh.
And then come back to it again because, you know, in the end of it, you're probably only wanting to communicate three things overall, and how you do that is, you know, is part of how you present it. But if you hear that they're not hearing exactly or not fully understanding, stop and just say it again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how heads will perk up and get at that time, and it also adds something to the quality of how you're speaking. The most powerful thing you've mentioned a couple of times, and that is the pause, and that is a, you know, that is something that you study and learn, and being not afraid of silence, like just now, and being and realizing that if you stop and don't say anything, it's often more powerful than if you just keep talking.
It is always more powerful.
Yeah. It's just an extremely powerful. And the thing is to not overuse it, but when you do pause and let some silence come in, people kind of recalibrate. You know, they have their internal reset button go. And they realize that you've either just said something important that they should be thinking about, or you're just about to. So I think that that's part of it. And I think overall, you know, it's a little like you producing a show. I think that when you produce a talk, if you're doing it just yourself or you're doing it with other people, you spend the same amount of time on the details. Sound is very important. The sound quality, the kind of microphone is very important. The notion of modulate, you know, I used to put notes in my speeches for when I was going to raise my voice or when I was going to lower it way, way down and be almost a whisper like. Because it's an orchestration. You know, if you were listening to a piece of music and it was always at the same volume and basically, you know, playing the same note over again, you'd get bored very quickly.
Yeah. I do that with this show. I modulate my voice in various ways.
Yeah, you do.
Well, yep. those are great tips. And have you ever heard of Bert Decker?
Yes.
He runs Decker Communications out here in San Francisco. He's written what I consider to be the definitive book on public speaking. He talks about tapping into your limbic system, your emotional core of your audience. And he does also believe that you have three topics. And he has this thing he calls I think everybody calls it the Decker grid. Out of this world helpful. And getting speaker training from him is so amazing. And he's coming on Dishy Mix in, I think, next week. I got him coming
wonderful.
On next week, maybe 2 weeks from now.
And
I found him, believe it or not, I found him on Twitter. I saw Bert Decker on Twitter and I thought, is it the Bert Decker? I've always been, you know, I've never met him and I've always been this tremendous fan of his work. I think he's the definitive speaking teacher.
Isn't that wonderful?
I know. It's funny, isn't it? Some of those things.
Yeah, no, it's great.
And makes
you know, there is no more powerful tool, as you know.
That's right.
If you have ideas to communicate.
That's right. And to be a leader.
And
to,
yeah,
be a leader.
To be a leader.
You
yep.
have to be a good speaker to
Absolutely.
Win in this world now.
Absolutely.
So we're totally out of time. Here's what I want to do.
Yep.
One last thing I want out of you, Bob.
Yep.
You told me the axiom by which you ran your life was living well is the best revenge. Clearly,
yep.
you know what you're doing. And I want you to tell me one or two little fun stories about the Studio 54 era. What is something that just really you remember about that time in your life of living well?
Well, I'm not sure that was living well, by the way. I think it was living during an amazing time where, and I was fortunate, I guess, to be single at the time. I'm very happily married to my second wife, but I was single for 10 years in between, and that was part of those 10 years. Thank goodness, because I don't know, you know, what else would might have happened there. But it was the most. It was a time where, for a brief moment, there was suspension of all rules, you know, and a lack of knowledge. You know, this was pre-AIDS and,
yeah.
and pre as ultra drug concerned as people have become, and there was this free freedom thing going on that was very hard to really capture. And along with that freedom came along early disco and then, you know, other kinds of music that sort of added to it. But I have to say, the first time I ever walked into Studio 54, and by the way, I don't know, a lot of people don't know this, but it used to be Studio 52, which was the CBS radio studio.
Oh.
And it started as a studio, and the address changed to 54 West whatever street it was on, and that's how it was named, Studio 54. But the first time I walked in and heard this amazing sound and these bodies on the dance floor and stuff just whirling around in the air and this, you know, this very this atmosphere of, it was decadent, but it wasn't dirty decadent. It was just plain decadent.
Yeah.
And I guess it was the first time I'd ever understood the experience of what was then to become unisex restrooms much later on in history. Because they were all unisex at that point. And it was just that, you know, I think that the sense of it all was great. My wife tells a story that, and I used to like going out to clubs, just generally. I liked to dance. Mm. And it wasn't just Studio 54. You know, you'd start there maybe and then go to the China Club or go to the Mud Club downtown or go to the Palladium or others, and you could spend a good deal of the night. Fortunately, during that era, that's when I was a CEO of that joint venture with YNR. Fortunately, I had a driver, so I didn't have to worry about drinking and driving and all that other stuff, and I lived in the city, so, you know, I wasn't out all night, but it was certainly late nights. When I first started dating Stacy, who would then become my wife, Terrence, who was my driver, confided in her, because she didn't like clubbing, didn't like going out, confided in her 3 months later, I think, you saved my life.
Terrence was exhausted.
He was exhausted.
I love it. That is funny. Well, and it's funny too, because now you've graduated. I think there's actually a graduation where you start farting through velvet and now you're farting through Naugahyde, but it's the Naugahyde on your yacht. And it makes a better sound.
Oh, thank you. That's true. That's very funny.
I love it. I have had so much fun reconnecting with you, Bob. I've just always thought you were such a terrific guy. Always very, very approachable and very connected in. I wish we had more time to talk. There were a lot of, I wanted to hear that story about how you took the creative business ideas and the 100 days and the 100 people and you essentially created a new culture in the whole Euro RSCG global network. We don't have time to do that, but will you come back sometime and talk to us some more?
I would love to.
I would love to have you.
I would love to. Maybe you come visit on the yacht. We'll do it on the yacht.
That would be good. I've got portable recording equipment. There has to be good wine involved, though. If you really want me, there's got to be something good. What do you got to put on the table?
Oh, we've got some very good wine.
For the man whose axiom by which he lives his life is living well is the best revenge, I'll bet you do. It's been so nice to have you on, Bob. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Susan. I enjoyed it very much.
Good. All right. Well, I'm your host, Susan Bratton. You just got to get to know Bob Schmetterer. And I hope you had a great day. And don't forget to join me at dishymixfan.com. And I will talk to you next week. I've got another great show for you. Rennie Gleason from Wyden & Kennedy is coming up. Talk to you soon. Have a great day. Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.